It's midday and time for the news, read by Danielle Yawavietska.
Israeli forces and Hezbollah have been engaged in close combat in South Lebanon, with the Israeli military saying that two soldiers have been severely wounded. The Lebanese authorities have said Israeli airstrikes killed at least 15 people in different parts of the country. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has called on the UN to move its peacekeepers out of what he called harm's way in southern Lebanon after five were wounded in recent days. Israel's been criticised for not ensuring their safety. The Business Secretary Jonathan Reynolds says the government had to have a conversation with the logistics firm DP World to secure its investment in a port in Essex after its subsidiary was criticised by the Transport Secretary Louise Hague. Ms Hague called for a boycott of P&O ferries for its record on workers' rights, putting the £1 billion investment at risk ahead of a major investment summit. The leader of the conference in North Macedonia, where Alex Salmond died, has said the forum is in shock over his death. The former SNP leader died suddenly aged 69 yesterday. Mark Donfried, the director of the Academy for Cultural Diplomacy, said Mr Salmond was in the best of spirits beforehand. The government is advertising a six-year contract worth more than £500 million to manage two sites in Kent used to process people arriving in the UK on small boats. About 27,000 people have made the crossing so far this year. President Biden is due in Florida, where he's expected to announce more than $500 million in funding to restore power grids damaged by Hurricanes Milton and Helene. More than 3 million people and businesses are still without power in the wake of the storms, which killed at least 23 people. In just over an hour's time, Elon Musk's rocket company SpaceX is due to conduct another test flight of its Starship spacecraft. Starship, the most powerful rocket ever flown, will attempt to head to space before splitting in two. It's then hoped that the booster stage will return to the launch pad, where SpaceX will attempt to catch it for the first time. A look at the weather, and this afternoon sunny spells will gradually be replaced by cloud and increasing winds from the west. Rain will arrive in western areas by this evening. Highs of 9 degrees in Belfast, 10 in Cardiff, 8 in Edinburgh and 11 in London. And that's the BBC News and weather at 12:02. Well, now it's time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay.
Sarah Ogilvie is a proud, self-confessed word nerd. Languages are her passion, and at the heart of her writing and scholarship, she was an editor at the Oxford English Dictionary and went on to write a book about the thousands of volunteers around the world who submitted words for its first edition. She's researched endangered languages in Australia, North America, and most recently Indonesia. She's also the co-author of Gen Z Explained, where she analysed how 16 to 25-year-olds communicate with each other in words, images and emojis. She's currently a senior research fellow at the University of Oxford. Music, Sarah, is clearly a passion too. You've brought a great range of choices, Mozart, Allegri, Nina Simone. But I think we're going to start with Monteverdi, Beata Sfera.
We are, Michael. Beata Sfera is one of my favourite motets because it's joyful and it's an absolute delight. And it brings me back to when I first moved to Oxford to work as an editor on the Oxford English Dictionary, attending Evensong at New College. And this particular piece is conducted by Edward Higginbottom when he was director of music at New College. And I think he manages to get the most exquisite sound out of his choir.
Thank you. So, so best in time to be.
Beata's Fear by Monteverdi, performed by the Choir of New College, Oxford, and the Capricorn Orchestra, conducted by Edward Higginbottom. You were born, Sarah Ogilvie, in Australia. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Brisbane, Australia, which back then was a large country town, really. Now it's quite a city.
What was it like for you growing up there?
Well, my father was a well-known hat designer, of all things, and he also played jazz piano. And he and my mother would host a lot of parties. The champagne would be flowing and he'd be playing piano and everyone would end up dancing and singing around the piano. And so I really grew up in quite a fun household. Every day Dad would play piano. Every night before bed I'd climb in under his baby grand.
He was a tap dancer as well, wasn't he?
He was. He started out as a child tap dancer, and then he was very good at mathematics and became an accountant and was leading a very normal life working for the government treasury. But during the lunch hours, he would make hats for the women in the office and he'd put them out to dry on the treasury steps in Brisbane, and the women in the office would say, "Patrick, these hats are fantastic, you have to do this," rather than accountancy. So in his 20s, he took the leap and left a very secure job. And thank goodness he did that, because he then lived a creative life and followed his passion.
And this next piece by Nina Simone reminds you of him, doesn't it?
It really does. I mean, Nina Simone performed this in Montreux in 1976 in front of a largely white audience. And she had just been living in Liberia for a couple of years. This was her first return to Europe. And I think you really sense at the end of this how this is a protest song. And towards the end, you really feel the anger coming out. And I find that particularly moving.
I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all chains still binding me, yeah. Wish I could say all the things that I can say when I'm relaxed. Starting anew. I wish I could be like a bird in the sky. Don't leave me. How sweet it would be to find that I could fly. I'd soar to the sun and look down at the sea. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. Then I'd sing, 'cause I know how it feels to be free. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Wish I could break bind us apart. Wish you could know what it means to be me. you'd see, you'd agree, everybody should be free, cause if we ain't, we're murderous. Wish I could be like a bird in the sky. How sweet it would be. It's moving now. I know, got news for you, I already know. Jonathan Livingston Seagull ain't got nothing on me.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. A live performance by Nina Simone at the Montreux Jazz Festival in 1976, and the song composed by Billy Taylor and Richard Lamb. Now tell us a little bit, Sarah Ogilvie, about your mother, because I think she was quite an adventurous person.
My mother was very into paleontology and herpetology. And so I used to go with her and her best friend, Jeanette Kovacevic, who was a famous Australian herpetologist.
Somebody who specialises in snakes.
In snakes, yes. Yeah. And not diseases.
Not herpes.
That's right. And so every winter, Jeanette would take us out with her to the Simpson Desert to collect snakes for their anti-venom. And so I had quite an exciting childhood accompanying them on those trips out to the desert or on other fossil digs that they would go on together.
Was that frightening sometimes?
Well, it was for me because Jeanette would collect the snake, put it into a calico bag, tie the calico bag, then put that into another bag just in case it nosed its way through the corner of the first bag, and then just put them on the back seat of the four-wheel drive right next to me, and I'd sort of sit there looking at these bags expecting them to thrash around, but they never did. The snake would just lie there very quietly.
And she discovered one of the most venomous snakes in the world, didn't she?
It is. So the eastern taipan snake actually has the most toxic venom in the world, but its fangs are a bit shorter than a few other snakes, so it's actually ranked fourth. Mm. But basically, a child is dead within 6 or 7 minutes, and then a grown man would die in about 15 minutes. So it's extremely dangerous.
Yeah. And so would you be around when they were actually trying to catch these snakes?
Yes, and we'd be driving across the Barkly Tableland, which is where the snake particularly lives, and Jeanette would be driving and she'd observe the grass moving in a particular way, slam on the brakes, run out, go down into the grass and come up with one of these snakes. She was extraordinary.
With her bare hands?
Mm, yeah.
Good God. So she had to know what she was doing.
Oh, definitely.
And did it develop a love of reptiles in you at all?
No, I'm absolutely petrified of reptiles. But what it did instill in me is a love for nature, a respect for nature, especially the wild Australian outback.
Mozart next, and I think the performer here is important as well.
She's very important. It's Mitsuko Uchida, who is my favourite pianist, and I was introduced to Mitsuko Uchida when I was about 12 by Bernadette O'Shea, who is a champagne expert. She's the first Australian woman to win the Vin de Champagne Award, and she was my dad's best friend, and each weekend dad would go to Bernadette's house and take me with him for champagne tasting. And they gave me my
own... sounds like an idyllic childhood.
And they would give me my own glass and I'd sit on the floor at their feet and I would take notes. And I still have my notebooks. And by the looks of my writing, I think I was about 6 or 7 when I started. So Mozart reminds me of Bernadette O'Shea, but also for me, it is the sound of mathematics. And my first degree was in pure mathematics, and I always played Mitsuko Uchida's wonderful complete Mozart sonatas as I did my mathematics. And for me, the music mirrors what mathematics is like. There's a surface accuracy and logic, but once you get into it, there's this creativity and there's joy to it. I also think about what it's like when you're a lexicographer and you go into the meaning of a word and you try and tease out the patterns of how that word behaves and what the different nuances of meaning are.
Thank you.
think there's no one for me that has the precision, the control and the restraint that she has. It seems to me, as just a listener, that with the slower sonatas, it's so hard to hide behind the speed. And so it really takes great skill because you're really exposed and vulnerable. But is that true when you play?
Yes, I think so. The more naked music is, the more it depends on the interpretive powers of the pianist. It's the ability of Ushida to slow and to speed up just in a certain way. Mm-hmm. Other people could do that and it would become indulgent.
Exactly. And also, you know, when you really get into pure mathematics, you have those decisions to make yourself. You can see that you could choose one particular direction, but usually you want to make the most elegant choice. And I could imagine that for a player, it's a similar thing.
Yeah, exactly. The Adagio from Mozart, Sonata number 18 in D major, performed by Mitsuko Ushida. You studied Sarah Ogilvie for a BSc in Computer Science and Pure Mathematics at the University of Queensland. Maths was your first love, as you said. So when did words come into the equation?
It was actually while I was studying for my finals in maths. I was in my college library and it was late at night, and on the bookshelf in front of me, I took a book off as a break, and it was a book called Language by Edward Sapir, written in 1921. And I had no idea that this was actually a foundational text in linguistics. In this book, Edward Sapir talks about going and living with the Hopi North American Indian community and observing that their concept of time isn't linear like ours, but that it's cyclical. And this has since been disproved, but it just helped me realize that it's through language that we can get access to someone else's view of the world, and that language really is the key to culture. And so after reading that, I thought I really must study linguistics, and it became my passion, especially lexicography, the writing of dictionaries.
And is there a link in music, linguistics, maths, in patterns?
I think so. And for me, I'm the type of linguist. I'm not the linguophile who's wonderful at speaking languages, but I'm the type of linguist who loves to look for patterns and loves to explore the structure and the morphology of language.
So you did an MA in linguistics at the Australian National University in Canberra. And for your thesis, you went to live with an Aboriginal tribe whose language was endangered.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the history of this particular tribe and what happened to them.
Yeah, so this language was only spoken by two speakers. There were only two people left speaking this language. The language is called Morabolama, and they were living on the very tip of remote northern Queensland. When I went to live with them in the early 90s, they had been living there for 30 years. So 30 years before that, in 1963, they had been living on their traditional lands, which are about 1,000 miles south in Princess Charlotte Bay, which is that hook in the Queensland coast. And they had been living there for centuries. But inland from there is a large cattle station owned by a prominent Queensland family who didn't like the fact that this Aboriginal tribe was living on their traditional lands. So they organised with the Queensland police and the Queensland government for a boat to come to the shore. And they told the community that they were going to be taken to the tip of Cape York for mandatory medical treatment and that they'd be brought back in 1 week. So the people trusted that. They only took 1 week's supply and they got onto this boat. And these two old women, Nico and Mabel, told me that in their traditional canoes, they'd never been more than half a mile, certainly not more than a mile off the coast. So they're on this boat. And people were getting frightened. Some of them were starting to be sick. And they looked back to the beach and they just saw smoke rising from their humpies. So they knew that they had been tricked. They were taken to the tip of Cape York, but there were no doctors there. Two of the elders tried to walk back. They were hunted down by mounted police. One of them was shot dead. The other was put into chains and made to walk back. And in that 30 years, everyone had died from that original group except for these two old sisters. and they had been forced to live with 8 other tribes that similar things had happened to.
Yeah. And that's a very inhospitable part of the world to be dumped on, isn't it? I mean, that's near Cape Tribulation, probably, is it?
Far north than even there. And so I had the privilege of living there over a 2-year period, and I was the only white person living in the community. It was a difficult experience for me at the time, but in retrospect, a very rich and life-changing one. There was a lot of drinking and violence within that community, but I was fortunate because I got to live with this elder called Goody Massey, and he kept me safe. But there was no electricity in the community and therefore no recorded music, except someone, somewhere. I never managed to locate the source. They had a cassette recorder, one of those beat boxes, with just a single song on it that they used to play on repeat. And they used to play this song very early in the morning as the sun was rising. And I'd be lying in my swag, it's like a sleeping bag really, on the red dusty ground, listening to the incongruous sounds of Elvis Can't Help Falling in Love.
Wise men say only fools rush in, but I can't help falling in love with you. Shall I stay? Would it be if I can't help falling in love with you? Like a river flows surely to the sea, darling, so it goes. Some things are meant to be.
Even though you heard it every morning, did you fall in love with that song?
I'm not really a big Elvis fan, I must admit.
Actually, interestingly, Can't Help Falling in Love by Elvis Presley was in fact based on a French song, Plaisir d'amour. So I think it had been through several transitions, rather like language. And I was going to say, did you manage to take down this language in a way that became helpful?
Well, I did. I managed to learn enough to write a small dictionary and a grammar. And I can remember when I took a bundle of the dictionaries back up to the community. And my teachers, Nico and Mabel, didn't really get what writing and reading was until the moment when they held the book and one of their granddaughters could read and she started to pronounce some of the words. And they thought this was magic. They were crying, but also laughing. They were really amazed. And so I was really thrilled by that. But after about 10 or 15 minutes, I noticed people sort of forgot about the dictionary and, you know, the daily life within this community took over. And I saw that there were a bunch of the dictionaries just kind of thrown into a pile. Then there was a fire and some of the dictionaries were destroyed and they took that as a sign that they shouldn't be really delving into traditional business. So I did feel a bit disillusioned because I thought, oh, all that work for nothing really. But then I managed to go back about 15 years later and they had cleaned up the community. They had decided to be a dry community where there wasn't drinking and they were using the dictionary to try and teach the language to the children in the school. So it ended up being a happy ending.
After your MA, Sarah, you went to live in Rome. What drew you there?
Well, I was working as a lexicographer for Oxford Dictionary in Australia and then for the Macquarie Dictionary. I was idealistic in my 20s. I felt like it wasn't making a contribution to the world. So I took a year out and I went to Rome and worked for the Jesuit Refugee Service, doing advocacy for them at the United Nations in Geneva.
You lived in Vatican City. What was that like?
Yes, so the Jesuit Curia is part of the Vatican. And in fact, there were three of us who were in our 20s, three young women, and we were all over 6 foot. And we were very sporty, so we loved to go and swim in the Vatican swimming pool. But it was a little bit unusual because every time that we'd go to swim there, the lanes would be taken up by cardinals, all wearing matching red silk trunks. And they'd really stick in their lanes too, and it was really hard for us to swim around them.
And your next piece of music is from that time.
Yes, I befriended three people at the American Academy in Rome. They were the composer Martin Bresnik, the pianist Lisa Moore, and a poet, Tom Andrews. And despite being a haemophiliac, Tom Andrews had a passion for motorcycles. And I used to hop on the back of Tom's motorcycle and we'd ride out to Ostia, which is the ancient port of Rome. Tom actually died suddenly the following year, not from a motorbike accident, but from a rare blood disease. And Tom was only 40. And so Martin Bresnik decided to compose a piece in honour of Tom, using one of Tom's poems called My 20th Century. And I particularly love the reference in this piece to the death of Tom's brother. It's a refrain that keeps coming in at sort of unexpected moments, which I always attribute to grief, how grief can strike you at the most unexpected moments. And I love that in this particular piece. Also, I like ambiguous endings. And in fact, Lisa plays on this, the wonderful pianist Lisa Moore. And this piece has a particularly poignant, darkly ambiguous closing.
It's performed by the Povera players and different members from the group speak the lines of the poet Tom Andrews.
I ate sweet apples in the 20th century. I ate my peck of dirt in the 20th century.
I ate my words in the 20th century.
My brother died in the 20th century.
Thank you. I wrote passionate letters in the 20th century. I was incapable of keeping silent in the 20th century.
I shed pints of blood in the 20th century.
My brother died in the 20th century.
Like a lampshade over my life in the 20th century. I prayed to the Son of Man in the 20th century.
It was nearly possible to live in the 20th century.
My brother died in the 20th century.
There was something very obvious in the 20th century I could never see or understand. The dead knocked on the door of my life in the 20th century. "Who's there?" I said.
My 20th Century, composed by Martin Bresnik, with words by the poet Tom Andrews, which were performed by the Povera players who were playing the instruments. There is a kind of anger, a grief in the repetition.
Yes, I think so. Mm.
You're listening to Private Passions, where my guest today is the self-confessed word nerd, Sarah Ogilvy. Sarah, after Rome, you moved to the UK to become an editor for the Oxford English Dictionary. Why did you want to join that institution, or was it simply an extension of your lexicography?
It really is an extension. The OED is really the mothership for lexicographers, so I was very excited to be able to work there.
The history of the OED is pretty amazing, because it took years to complete, didn't it?
It did. It began in 1858, and they thought that it would take 2 years. Then they thought it would take 10, and it ended up taking 70 years. And the reason why it took so long, and the reason why the OED was such a radical text for the middle of the 19th century, was because before then, dictionaries had really been prescriptive texts, telling people how words should be pronounced and what they really meant, how they should be used. But in the middle of the 19th century, a small group of men here in London at the Philological Society said, well, why don't we write a comprehensive dictionary of English, but let's take examples of how words are used from their natural habitat. And to do that, let's collect as many examples of how a word is used in a written source. And they realized that a small group of men couldn't do such a massive task alone. So they had the radical idea of crowdsourcing it. And they opened it up to people all around the world and said, can you read your local books and write out examples, quotations from those books to show us how your local words are used in a printed source, and write them out on little 4x6 inch slips of paper and send them to us. And they had no idea whether this would be a success or not. But in fact, so many people sent in slips that the Royal Mail had to put a red pillar box outside the longest-serving editor James Murray's house at 78 Banbury Road, Oxford. And if you go there today, the red pillar box is still there. There's now a blue plaque on James Murray's house.
It was finally finished in 1928 and heralded as a national treasure by the Prime Minister. You, Sarah, authored a book called Words of the World, A Global History of the Oxford English Dictionary, because it really was a global endeavour, wasn't it?
It really was. And what we didn't know when I wrote that book was who all those people were around the world who answered that call. And then it was just by chance that 10 years ago, I was taking up a new job at Stanford University, and I was waiting for my American visa to come through. So I decided to go and revisit my favourite parts of Oxford, one of which is the Oxford University Press basement, where all these slips are stored. And there are over 2 million slips in these grey acid-free boxes. And I just took the lid off a random box, and inside was a little black book tied with cream ribbon, which I'd never seen before. And I undid the ribbon, and when I opened it, I observed the immaculate handwriting of that longest-serving editor, James Murray. And this book was his 150-year-old address book with the names and addresses of all those people around the world who he corresponded with, who sent him in words and quotations. And not only their names and addresses, but he listed every book that each person read, the number of slips per book, and the date that he received them. So it was, for me, I immediately recognised the value of this book, and I thought, finally, we will know who all those people were. And I devoted the next 8 years to finding out as much as I could, and I collaborated. Stanford loved the project, and I collaborated with some of my students, and we basically just trawled censuses, marriage certificates, death records to find out as much as we could. And it ended up, Michael, they were very colourful characters.
And people still contribute, don't they?
Yes, that's the thing. So when I first started working for Oxford Dictionary, it was actually down in Australia. And I started out by opening the mail, and every month would come this bundle of slips, eccentrically wrapped in old cornflake packets with bits of dog hair and cereal stuck on them. And inside were slips from a gentleman who lived in Brisbane, Australia, my old hometown. And all of these slips were Australian words from a single source. They were from the local newspaper in Brisbane, not a very esteemed paper, called the Courier Mail. And over a 30-year period, this man called Mr. Collier sent in over 100,000 slips. And one day he rang the dictionary centre, and I got on the phone and I said, Mr. Collier, I'd love to meet you. And he said, oh, okay. So he said, meet me in a park behind the Paddo Tavern. Now, the Paddo Tavern is quite a rough pub, but I went to this park and there is this elderly gentleman sitting on a park bench reading a newspaper, of all things, the Courier Mail. And we sat and spoke for a few hours. And at the end of it, I said, "Mr. Collier, what do you say to the idea of flying you over to Oxford to show you the workings of the dictionary? You can meet the editors and it can be a thank you to you for your incredible service. Because, see, people are doing this for free." And he looked at me and he said, "Oh, but I couldn't possibly. Just imagine all the Courier Mails waiting for me when I got home."
Oh, wonderful. Well, we'll have more stories from the contributors to the OED, but we're going to deviate just a little bit for some more music. It's the Allegri Miserere. What is it that you love about this?
What I love about this, look, it's an exquisite piece, but what's intriguing about it for me is that glorious soaring high C is actually a mistake. It's a mistranscription of a false Bordone in the 19th century Groves Dictionary of Music, which was then mistakenly copied in the 20th century and now, of course, is fossilised in this famous piece, which is so loved by so many. So for me, it's those mistakes that are the most stunning part of the piece. And as a lexicographer, it reminds me that in times past, dictionaries held cultural capital and they held the power to standardize language, and in this case, to standardize music.
Thank you.
Miserere Mei Deus, composed by Gregorio Allegri and performed by the Cardinal's Music, conducted by Andrew Carwood. Your latest book, Sarah Ogilvie, is The Dictionary People, the unsung heroes who created the first Oxford English Dictionary. Was it tricky to track them down? I know you had the slips, but...
It was really hard because most of these people were not your established, well-known scholars. In fact, that's one of the revelations, is that many of them were autodidacts. They had left school early, as indeed did James Murray, the chief editor. He left school at 15 and taught himself 25 languages by comparing different versions of the Gospels. Many of these dictionary people were similar.
And they were so various. I mean, for example, people who were in prison or struggled with mental illness.
Yes, in fact, the top four contributors all had connections to psychiatric hospitals, which were called lunatic asylums back then. There were three murderers, only one of whom went to prison for his crime. There were so many more women than we realized. There were nearly 500 women, so there's a whole chapter in the book dedicated. It's W for women. In fact, there are 26 chapters from A to Z. A starts with archaeologist, the wonderful Margaret Murray, who was born in India, living in Calcutta. She starts at the age of 18. She reads the Bible. She reads travellers' tales of India and sends in hundreds of Indian words, which then get into the dictionary. She actually becomes one of the first female archaeologists. So yes, there are many different colourful characters.
And then P for pornography and a man called Henry Spencer Ashby.
He lived in Bloomsbury and had the world's largest collection of two things, Cervantes and pornography. And thankfully, he delved into his pornographic collection and sent in hundreds of words to do with sex and the body. So it's thanks to him, and I'm sure that his bundles of slips would perhaps make James Murray blush when they arrived in the scriptorium in Oxford.
Yes, because Murray had a wonderful setup in his garden, didn't he, to collate all of this?
Yes, Murray started to write the dictionary inside the family house, and his long-suffering wife and 11 children, Ada, his wife, said, "James, there are too many books and slips here inside the house, and too many children." So she pushed him out into the back garden where he built a corrugated shed, basically, and he partially dug it into the ground. And of course, in Oxford weather, in the winter, it's very dank and cold, and the editors used to have to wrap their legs in newspaper to stay warm.
We're going to hear next a sound rather than a piece of music. Tell me what this is.
Yes, so when I was researching the book, I was actually living in California, and every vacation I would come to Oxford to do research in the beautiful Bodleian Library, which I love so much, because that is where the Murray papers are stored. And I would return to Stamford and I would miss Oxford. And so I would play this. This is a recording of the Western Library within the Bodleian Library.
Did that do it for you?
It did do it for me. How about you?
Well, I was just waiting for a shh from somebody who's making to work.
I think that comes in about the 23 minutes and 10 seconds point.
We haven't got enough time to wait for that. No. Sounds to Study To, the Western Library, the Bodleian, recorded actually by Oxford University. Next, we move on to Gen Z, about which I'm probably more ignorant than I should be, and you're going to enlighten me.
Am I? I'm still puzzled by Gen Z myself. I'm still learning things every day. But 8 years ago, I was with colleagues at Stamford, and we were all saying that that year's student body was very different from the previous year. And we realised that, in fact, that was the first year of students who had never known the world without the internet. They had all been born after 1994, when the World Wide Web was launched. And so I was interested in their language, and I collaborated with an anthropologist, with an historian, and with a sociologist, and I created a large database of their language, a 70 million word corpus called the iGen corpus that scraped their language from Twitter, from Twitch, from 4chan, which is known as the asshole of the internet because it's where all the hackers and anonymous hang out. So the language is wonderfully colourful. And by analysing this large database, I was able to say some fun things about their language.
Yes, what did you learn about the way society is changing as a result of this? I mean,
we observed they really prioritise collaboration. Identity is very important to them, so there is a great respect for diversity, especially diversity of one's gender and sexuality. Community is very important to them. So, yeah, we found a lot to be positive about.
Do you ever feel slightly sad at the thought that we have lost the art of letter writing, longhand, all of these things which you would have researched in the course of your life?
Well, I think that more young people than ever are reading and they're writing. They might be texting, but they're still reading and writing. And so I have hope. And, of course, if you look at their language, so many new words are being created and they're also spreading faster than ever, thanks to social media. I mean, the role of the lexicographer today, it's really exciting because you can basically track the life of a word in real time.
So let's hear a little example from the way Gen Z language is being used.
Well, one interesting thing to look at is how they're developing tone within their texting. So, for example, if you text in capitals, that's no go because you're shouting and that's aggressive. Taking just the word okay, a lowercase k is much different from an uppercase k. And if you put a full stop at the end, that's a very aggressive okay, I guess, yes, because what you've done is you've taken the time to get to the full stop. So, yes, there are lots of nuances.
And also lots of traps for people of my generation.
You said it.
Was it the song or the singer that attracted you to this next piece?
Well, this next piece is a bit of a gear change, and I guess it's because my life took a bit of a gear change when I was living in California. I became friends with a wonderful man called Steve Jensen, who in fact is a manager of pop stars. And so I, thanks to Steve, was brought in to the world of pop, and he manages Katy Perry and K.D. Lang, and this next piece is a very beautiful piece by K.D. Lang, and it reminds me of California, and it just reminds me of the complexity of love and of life.
Maybe it was to learn how to love, maybe it was to learn how to leave, or maybe it was for the games that we play. Maybe it was to learn how to choose, maybe it was to learn how to lose, or maybe it was for love that we made. Love was everything they said it would be. Like an old tin drum, I can't wait for you to make the whole kingdom come. So I'm leaving. Maybe it was to learn how to fight, maybe it was to lessen our
Love is Everything, composed by Jane Sibbery and performed by K.D. Lang. Sarah Ogilvie, another area that you're interested in are languages that are endangered, which I suppose takes us back to your time in Australia. And it's terrifying, the projection that half of the world's 6,800 languages could become extinct or fall asleep in the next century.
That's right. I mean, languages are falling asleep, as we like to say, because we like to think that if there is a record of a language when it stopped being spoken, then there is a chance of that language being revived and brought back to life. And if we look at the rate that languages are dying, on average, linguists say that a language is dying out every 2 weeks. And if that is the rate, then we will lose half of the world's languages by the end of this century.
That's an extraordinary thought.
It really is, because an entire way of viewing the world disappears with a language, as does, in many cases, literature, music, the entire culture. So this is vital.
I mean, in music, we think, for example, of folk song as being a way of preserving the way people entertained each other. Mm. But words are absolutely inimical to that, and virtually everything else.
Yes, and down in Australia, with the Australian Indigenous languages, in many of the land rights claims, legally, the community must show an uninterrupted connection with their traditional land, which, if you think of the story that I told you before about the Morabolama people, you might think that that's impossible because they were forced off it in 1963. But often it's through the songs and the words and the lyrics within those songs that are often about the landscape. So it's been very important to a lot of these land claims for musicologists and anthropologists to collaborate with the Indigenous communities and show that through the lyrics of many of their songs, they have had an uninterrupted connection with their land.
You're currently working on a language from Indonesia, aren't you?
Yes, I'm collaborating with a team of 17 people in six different countries, and we are writing dictionaries, you know, a mobile phone dictionary, an online dictionary, an historical diachronic dictionary of a language called Engano, which is spoken just south of Sumatra.
Now, Sarah, I suspect there just might be some people listening to us today who think, I would love to contribute to the OED. I've got some ideas. Can they still do that?
They can. And in fact, the OED launched a new website last year. And when you look up a word, there's now a button that says contribute. And you can send a message directly to the editors about that word. So you might find an earlier citation, let them know about a new meaning or a usage. And you can do that, which I think is wonderful because it really shows how they still value the contribution of the public.
Now, finally, a piece of music you actually commissioned.
Yes, my partner turned 60 last year, and so I commissioned this piece by the British composer James Whitbourne, a short anthem that's a setting of the third collect of Evensong called Lighten Our Darkness. And I particularly chose this because my partner's mother died of dementia and had a particular form of dementia called Lewy body dementia, which reacts badly to shadows and to darkness. So at night, if there was a dark part of the room, she would have visions and see people without limbs. It's a very distressing form of dementia. But she found great solace in this prayer. So James composed this piece, which I think is very beautiful. And he was actually dying of cancer while he was composing this. So this was one of his final compositions. He passed away in March of this year, and I like to hope that as he was working on this piece that the words brought him solace, just as they do me when I listen to them. And he composed this with the choir of Harris Manchester College in mind, where he was director of music, and that college is also where my partner is the principal today, so it's got extra meaning. The part of this that I love most are the amens at the end, because they're not definitive and triumphant. There's a hesitation in them, and they're not proclamations of certainty like we hear so often. They carry doubt and hesitation, and that, I think, really depicts the frailty of our human condition.
Well, doubly poignant note on which to finish. Sarah Ogilvie, thank you very much.
Thank you, Michael. It's been a privilege.
Thank you.
Light in Our Darkness, composed by James Whitbourne and performed by the choir of Harris Manchester College, Oxford, at his memorial service earlier this year, conducted by Stephen Taylor. And it was the final choice of Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions today, the lexicographer Sarah Ogilvie. Private Passions was produced by Claire Walker. And next week's guest is the American writer Garth Greenwell. That's here on BBC Radio 3, just after the midday news. We're off on a musical journey to one of the best-known pieces for strings and organ in just a moment here on Radio 3. Stay with us as we join Sarah Moore-Peach for Music Map after this.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music.
When I started singing, it was precious because I got to sort of express emotions that I didn't get to express in my daily life, you know?
Friday night is music night.
Fantastic. Yeah, absolutely brilliant.
Well, it's just spectacular.
I feel like music conveys emotion in a way that nothing else does.
BBC Radio 3, the home of classical music. Listen on your radio, on your smart speaker, and on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 3. Hello and a warm welcome if you're just joining us this Sunday afternoon. Danielle Jaworowiecka here with you today. Thanks for your company. Now at 1:30, it's time for Music Map with Sarah Moore-Peach.
Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3's Music Map, the show where we use a single piece of classical music as a blueprint for a listening journey, delving into the past and fast-forwarding to the future, listening in to sonic connections as a way of priming the ear for our musical destination, which today is this. The chances are this is a piece of music you've heard before, even if you can't place it. It's been used in countless film scores, from last year in Marion Bad to Flashdance. It's appeared on compilation albums for sublime relaxation and in spectacular Olympic ceremonies. To give it its full title, it's the Adagio in Sol minore per archi e organo su due spunti tematici e su un basso numerato di Tommaso Albinoni. Or, less of a mouthful, it's Albinoni's Adagio. Except it's not by the 18th century Italian composer Tommaso Albinoni at all. It was written in 1958 by Remo Giazzotto, who claimed to have found a fragment in a library and completed it. More on that murky story later. For now, let's begin with another musical completion, also shrouded in mystery.